We've been very focused on the practice of medicine for 2 years now, watching and wondering how the healing sciences will find the key to at last getting the COVID-19 pandemic under control. It's been a reminder that medical science is vast, but not limitless. We turn to a more personal story of practicing medicine in this hour. Our guest has been a pediatrician for more than 4 decades and clearly loves his work. And he shares that love, as well as some frustrations with the business of medicine, in a new book. Dr. Mark Vonnegut is the author of The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics. Dr. Mark Vonnegut is the son of the late Kurt Vonnegut and his first wife, Jane Cox. Mark detailed his struggles with psychotic episodes in 2 previous books, The Eden Express, and Just Like Someone Without Mental Illness, Only More So. He joined us on the JX to talk about that second book in October of 2011. So, Mark Vonnegut, this is a welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
It is a pleasure to have you. Your dedication is, thank you for letting me have such a good time when I go to work. Who's that dedication to?
That dedication is to my patients and my parents. And it's also a dedication to my wonderful teachers who, gave me a wonderful education.
But it's been a good time, really. I mean, you described some of the downs as well as the ups, but it sounds like, by and large, you still have a lot of love for the work.
I do. And my fear is that the next generation of patients and doctors won't have some of the same choices I've had.
Like what? Like, what are some of the things that you were able to choose that you don't think they'll be available even to them?
Primary care, pediatrics, when they come out of school with $500,000 of debt, they have to go into specialties that allow them to pay that back. And I was also able to practice medicine on my own terms, and I honestly, and I think an awful lot of doctors and nurses would do it for free if we could afford it.
Huh. You must work with some people who are younger than yourself, just as a guess here. But and I wonder how differently they cast their experiences when you talk about the things that you remember from your first days.
Yeah, I do. I teach medical students, and a lot of this stuff comes up, and I say, it's up to you to fix it. My generation, we did what we could, and I do think the situation is fixable. I think we can get back to the mission of medicine and have the money be less important, and that would be a wonderful thing. High quality medical care is a very, very valuable thing for a society to have.
So how would we address that particular part of it, where you could get more people to go into primary care and pediatrics because they wouldn't emerge with so much in student debt?
Right. And when you ask, what does it cost to educate and train a doctor in France or Germany or a lot of the answer is zero, because those societies believe that a well-trained doctor is a good investment, and they're right.
Wow. Is that something you're recommending for the United States, is to do the same thing?
It would be a huge help for people to follow their own passions about what they wanted to do. In medical school, you do rotations in surgery. I especially loved plastic surgery, but you get to say, I like pediatricians better. I like children because they're so resilient and they have a sense of humor. So you get to choose what you like rather than what's going to pay you a lot of money.
All right. So not only do they need to make some money, but all the other things that come with this, new regulations, new procedures. You detail in the book a bout of psychosis a few years ago, and you talk about electronic medical records in the same essay. And that's apparently not a coincidence.
No, I think electronic medical records were and are a missed opportunity to make medical care much more efficient. Instead, it's turned into billing and coding, and doctors in the room with you with computers. For a while, I was able to, have my providers, I say, here's a rule, no computers in the room. You have to look the patient in the face, get the story, do the physical exam, and you can do the computer stuff later.
So has the set of procedures that you do in medicine become about the computer more than about what you do with the patient?
It has. It's a lot of things that didn't used to be, which are highly expensive and a problem. I would put co-payments, deductibles, prior authorizations, and closed networks and open networks. I mean, there's a lot of things that you have to maneuver, along with the fact that you have, you know, something like a child with cancer. The at least part of the work is, too much of the work is getting the services that kid needs.
All right, so here's where we can go into our first break with an answer to one question from your perspective, which is where does all the money in medicine go? We've talked over and over again about how much more we spend than other industrialized countries and for outcomes that are not as good. Where does all the money in medicine go? Because the perception is that doctors anyway still make a bunch of money.
I'm not hurting at all, but I'm certainly not making anything like the average CEO of an insurance company makes between $20 and $50 million. The average CEO in a pharmaceutical industry is in a similar range. And so I think an awful lot of the money has gone into for-profit organizations, and it's also gone into a lot of unnecessary care, which doctors and nurses are compelled to do.
Mark, you're right that I saw and still see science as a refuge from ambivalence and uncertainty. Has that refuge in science taken a bit of a beating during the COVID pandemic?
It's something to hang on to. It's certainly, there always has been and there always will be quacks and
whoops. Did Opal drop him? Okay. Can we get Mark on the phone? Okay. All right. This is the Jefferson Exchange. Dr. Mark Vonnegut, our guest. He's on a computer line with us that comes in through a gadget we call Opal on our end. But every so often, something goes kablooey because it is a computer system, and so we're going to have to raise him on the phone now and talk to him that way. But the book, again, is called The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics. It is, I believe, Mark Vonnegut's third book. His previous book, written after his psychotic episodes in his youth, is called The Eden Express. He wrote a follow-up to that in 2010, published in 2010, called Just Like Someone with Mental Illness, Only More So. And that was the last time we talked to him here on the Jefferson Exchange. That was in October of 2011. And he's got a lot to talk about, not only about pediatrics and the joy of dealing with patients, but also with the issue of what's going on in medicine in America these days. Mark, you back with us?
Yeah, I am. And anyway, part of what makes medicine, what I was going to start talking about, is the prior authorizations, the fact that for years I had to write a letter that my patient Maggie still had no left leg, and I have to write every year that one of my paralyzed patients needs a wheelchair. And in general, I don't think patients, adults or children, pretend when they need medical care, and all the rigmarole the insurers make us go through makes everything much more expensive.
You mean people have to continue to justify that, yes, I still have the problem that brought me to medical attention in the first place?
Yes, they do. And they have to, if they need like catheters or some equipment, I have to write every year to get the insurer to pay for the diapers, whatever.
So talk about that particular part of the situation. You describe a situation with pediatrics and primary care early in your career in the late 70s, where it sounded like everybody had $20 and that's what it cost to treat them, and everybody walked away in pretty good shape, and there wasn't a lot of paperwork, et cetera. But things have changed radically since that time. I mean, we talked about the electronic medical records, the computers in the room, all that stuff. But for who?
You know, our overhead for a visit back there was $3. the overhead for our office in general was 27%. And if you're operating in that way, it's easy to give away care when it's appropriate. It's easy to make bonds with your patients and with the community. And it's much more efficient. I mean, we kept records on with carbon paper, and my children don't know what carbon paper is.
Wow, records of carbon paper. Yeah, it does seem like a long time ago. But so is, I guess, the major question is anything better? I mean, the quality of the potential quality of care with the science seems to be advanced a bit, but is it available to all the people it needs to be available to?
No, and that is the problem. The mission of medical care is to give care for people who need care. There we have lost 40% of our rural hospitals. We've lost 80% of community doctors. So there is simply, there is no access to care. There are several things that are better. The computers were and are wonderful, and I adopted electronic medical records very early, but I got to say what the details of those machines were, and they also cost about $100 per doctor. And the medications are better, but they are so expensive they're not accessible to a lot of people who need them. But there's a lot that's better. But what's not better is access to the improved care and the old care.
Dr. Mark Vonnegut is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics. Vaccines show up early in the book, not surprisingly, with your memories of the early polio vaccines. And, the stories of people lining up to make sure that their kids would be protected seem a bit different from what we're seeing in the world with the COVID-19 vaccines.
Incredibly different. And I remember you got put in the gym and you didn't get out of that gym until you had had your polio shot. And there was, I think, the threat of polio made parents, nobody questioned it. We have a polio vaccine, we're going to use it. And polio was not as deadly as Ebola, but we had the clear and present threat that made people eager to get immunizations.
What do you suppose is behind what happened with COVID, where this idea of a clear and present threat, even though it was demonstrable, particularly in the Delta wave and in the numbers of the Omicron wave, if not the intensity, why still is this sense of like, oh, it's not? I mean, how many times did I hear people say it's not real?
I truly think it has a lot to do with the internet, where not so smart ideas can spread like wildfire. And what I truly believe is that reading makes people smart, and that smartphones make them not so smart.
Okay, I'll have to remember that one. That's definitely a worthwhile quote. Let's talk about it. It's not, you obviously have a great care for the patients, but a lot of admiration for the doctors who came before you. You learned from some good people, it sounds like.
Wonderful people. And their mission was to respond to the needs of patients. What I was taught to do and what my teachers did is they went into a room and they said, how may I help you? How can I, and the question is, how can I be of service? And then use science and all the technology to meet those needs. And so it was doctors responding to patients and hospitals making that possible. It's all been turned around there, where hospitals are under incredible financial pressure. And so they have to make the doctors do the coding and the billing, and the doctors have to deal with the fact that that lack of caring and that care for money doesn't affect the health of their patients too much, which is more and more difficult to avoid.
You give us some glimpses of your training, Mark, and it's kind of cute that you call it playing dress up. What made you decide to go into medicine in the first place?
It was it was a reaction to the 60s in that we honestly believed the economy was going to collapse, the world was going to be in a total mess, and self-sufficient farms were going to be refuges. And when the world didn't end, and I was thinking, what would I or what should I have done in, you know, without the 60s, I said, I should have been a doctor. And so then I went to UMass Boston, and I got very lucky and got into medical school.
You described yourself as a hippie coming out of the 60s. I mean, was that a back to the land kind of thing? You were kind of taking refuge from the collapse of society that you saw coming?
Absolutely. So we built buildings, we started growing crops, what I want to emphasize is communes and stuff like that. It was not sex and drugs and rock and roll. There was a seriousness.
There was folk music too.
To what we were doing.
There was a seriousness. Yeah, you were saying. So
and there was, of course, foolishness and dangerousness. But there was, at our commune and others, there was, ecological, financial, food, there was a seriousness to it.
So there are lots of people who knew that world and miss that world, but you seem to find a way to admire what happened back then and the way that people thought back then and still live successfully in the world of today.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who have. I know one of my close friends there is a professor. One became an architect, and so forth. And so I think the expectation we had, and I think our parents and professors bear a lot of the blame. We're really told the world was ending and it was up to us to save it. And you shouldn't be telling people in their early 20s to save the world. They're just not good at it.
Mark Vonnegut is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Dr. Mark Vonnegut, he's an MD, and he works in pediatrics and has for a very long time. And he tells the story in his book of essays, The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics. It's a conversation you're welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange. A lot to talk about here with not just, the hippie days that Mark emerged from, but medical school and how different medicine was back then, what's happened to American medicine. You can join us and talk about all these categories here on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Or you can send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. So aside from having electronic medical records briefly drive you up a wall, how have you managed to live with the big changes? How have you at least kept smiling through them?
I have been my own boss. And when I started doing that, I just said, I will do this for free. I just want to be able to do it for, the rest of my life. And as I say, I've been able to do that mostly thanks to my wonderful patients. And I'm now taking care of babies. And I have tried to create, and I visualize it as an umbrella protecting my office and my doctors and nurses and patients. It's like an umbrella that's protecting us from, incoming missiles trying to wreck what we do.
Well, yeah, come to think of it, about treating the babies of lots of people that you've known through the years, it got you out of a speeding ticket at some point, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It does wonderful things like that. I drive a little too fast sometimes, and I was pulled over, and I was all, of course, nervous. And the cop said, you are my pediatrician. Get out of here. And I remember seeing, I was going to a landscaping place with a quarry and all this, and there was this huge, 6'5", incredibly muscular kid. And I looked at him, and he said, Dr. Vonnegut. And he said, I got big. I said, I guess you got big. I would love to be 6'4" and solid muscle.
Yeah, it's kind of past the point for us to get there, isn't it? At least the 6'4" part. Talk about the decision-making medicine. We've covered this a little bit so far, but I want to get a little further down the road of how much the decisions that are made about treatment. We talked about having to write a letter every year to tell the insurance companies, yes, this condition still exists in this patient. But on a day-to-day basis, there's the same sort of involvement, isn't there?
There is, and we have the time and the trust of our community to, talk people out of unnecessary procedures, talk people out of unnecessary medical care, and that was a lot of part of my education. But in our office, doctors are free to do things as they see fit. In a lot of medicine, that's not true because you are under pressure. There are codes for procedures, and a 99213 gets you about $50 less than a 99214 or 5, and the hospital knows they'll be audited, and your percentage of these, it's ridiculous. What the best tool I have for making the right diagnosis is having the patient tell their story without my interrupting them, and time. I make my best prediction. Fever will go away in 3 or 4 days. Child will get a rash and will be back to themselves. And if this doesn't happen, call me. Too much medicine is delivered by a doctor who you have never seen and will never see again. And so they don't have the tool of time or the trust of the community.
Talk about the $100 reward you once posted in the emergency room at the hospital where you worked, what that was for.
I was teaching, and again, it's teaching what's necessary and what's not necessary. There are routines for lots of complaints. And one of the routines for if a child came in with a fever is you got a complete blood count, CBC. And I had just never found it useful. I found the physical exam, the history, other things could tell you what the child had. And so I put up a $100 reward that if anybody could find a case where the CBC helped them make the diagnosis, the $100 was there.
And
it stayed there until I decided just to take it back.
How long did it stay up there?
A couple years, two or 3 years, but I made my point.
Yeah, you realize, so nobody ever learned anything from a CBC that they didn't already know.
Exactly, or that didn't confirm what they knew. And that can be a valid use for a test to prove that what you think is right is right. But I found it useless in terms of making a diagnosis.
All right, so that's the practice of medicine. Then we come back to the other side, the payment and organization of medicine, and you described the plan, the first local HMO, health maintenance organization. You make it sound like the Death Star.
In a way, it was, and the way they made money by insuring all these, young families, which one thing, ensure that you had intact families, and an income and probably healthy children, and to charge them the same that people who were sick were getting charged and keeping the difference. And that sort of taking care of people who don't need as much care and finding a way to evade taking care of the sick, that has dominated medical care for 30 or 40 years. The co-payments, the deductibles, all that.
you know, it's not just that you have had many chances over the 4 decades plus of your career to communicate your frustrations with what's happened to medicine, but lots of other people do so as well. And we continue to talk about some of the measures that it costs so much in America and doesn't deliver benefits relative to those costs. And but why doesn't it change then?
Well, I kind of say that we have the best Congress money can buy, and these for-profit corporations who are making huge amounts of money have huge political power. I think we should get away from things like Medicare for all, even though any kind of single-payer system would be much better than what we have, and operate with a principle everybody could identify with, which is do no harm. And you go through these things, whether it's what a doctor does or a hospital does or an insurer does, and you say that you can't do things that hurt patients. And that would eliminate a lot of the stuff that patients face trying to get care.
What was we've talked briefly in passing about the Health Maintenance Organization Act of 1973 that Congress passed and Richard Nixon signed, which allowed for-profit entities in healthcare for the first time. I mean, were some of the goals of the act potentially good for patient care? Have they been good for patient care? You're not crazy about the profit part, I get that, but did anything else work in there?
What would have worked and what was supposed to happen was that these corporations were supposed to compete on the basis of overhead, patient satisfaction, these things. But what happened is they became we talk about now the cost of care, and this is definitely part of the problem, and the insurers talk about less but better care. But what's really happened, what we forget about, is the cost of not caring. If you don't care for diabetes, it gets worse. It's the leading cause of blindness, of amputations, of heart disease, and kidney transplants. If you don't take care of people with heart disease, the costs get higher and higher and higher. So what it could have, if they were competing, and I think initially they did, on the basis of overhead and getting rid of unnecessary care, but that competition has all gone away, and what we're left with is they're competing for money, and what makes money is less care. Fewer ambulance rides, fewer hospitals, fewer doctors, nurses taking care of more patients than they can take care of in a hospital.
Let's take a phone call here, a little off the subject of medicine. Vince in Eugene is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Mark Vonnegut.
Hello there. Well, first, a personal note. I was a graduate student at the State University of New York at Albany, and I met your uncle, who was a famous earth scientist, I believe, my memory reminds me. And my roommate was an earth science major, and he just raved about your uncle's teaching lectures, and I did go to one of them and really enjoyed it. And I guess through your uncle's contact, the university asked your father to be the graduation speaker of the year we graduated, and he gave one of the best speeches I ever heard. It was all related to riding on a Ferris wheel through life and enjoying the different aspects of life and the people that you met. And it had a real influence on me to think carefully about my choices in life, and it was really wonderful. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about their careers and how they influenced you. And by the way, your book, Eden Express, was recommended to us in my course of instruction to become a counselor, and it really did influence me to work in my counseling career for the rest of my life.
All right. Thanks for that, Vince. A trio of Vonneguts. Mark on the line, his uncle Bernard Vonnegut, and, of course, his father, Mark Vonnegut. Sure, your thoughts, Mark?
Uncle Bernie is my favorite person in the world, and he used to take me to the Museum of Science in Boston. He had an even drier wit and a better sense of humor than my father, and listening to them compete telling the same jokes was a wonderful part of my childhood. My father was one of the best speakers, the best commencement speakers of all times. There is actually a book of his graduation speeches, which is called "If This Isn't Nice, What Is?" So it was wonderful to grow up in a family where reading and humor was so important.
It's interesting, though, to hear about Vince talking about Kurt Vonnegut and all his commencement speeches, and you confirming that. But there's that internet thing that got out there about the sunscreen speech, which was not Kurt Vonnegut.
Right, and a lot of people have sort of gotten on that. They think my father's easy to copy, but if you try to do it, it's not easy at all. So there are books which were written, science fiction books, under his name and under Kilgore Trout, which is one of his, characters. So, one of the prices of fame, and there are many, I think fame is horrible for people, is that people will put out false, imitations.
Yeah, indeed. Let's come back to the things that have happened to you in pediatrics, because some of the individual stories are quite moving and very interesting. I mean, and as you point out in the book, if you have a hard time being wrong, don't become a doctor. tell us about the patient you identify as Adeline. She had trisomy 13.
Yes, and when she was born, I don't think they had any other patients with trisomy 13. It's incredibly rare. And there were questions about, do we do this surgery? Do we give her a colostomy? And, do we help her with her cataracts and her blindness? Do we restore her hearing? Do we try to make it possible for her to walk? Do we immunize her? And at many points, I was wrong, but the parents stuck with me, among other reasons, because I kept telling them, you are the parent. You get to make this decision. And, your daughter Adeline has the misfortune of being an interesting patient. And so it draws a lot of curiosity and a lot of bad advice.
Now, normally people with trisomy 13 die very young, don't they? And how long did Adeline live?
Adeline lived to be 21.
Wow.
And I got, having told the parents that she was not going to live to be one, and then they called me one day, and said, she's out in the yard playing in the dirt with her siblings. Shouldn't we immunize her against tetanus? I said, yeah, we're going to start all the routine immunizations, so as I say, I was wrong more than I was right. But I stuck with the family and the patient, and eventually you get it right.
Another quote from you in the book, in pediatrics and most medical care, if the doctor can just shut up and listen long enough, the patient will reveal the diagnosis. Unfortunately, there's not a procedure code or template for how to shut up. For you in particular, coming from a family of storytellers, how counterintuitive was it to just let somebody else tell the story?
It wasn't counterintuitive at all.
Wow.
I learned to, as things are now, in the average interaction between a doctor and a patient, the patient is interrupted about 10 seconds into telling their story. 40% of the exam room time will be the doctor will be clicking on boxes in a computer, and so the patients never get to tell their story. One of the stories in the book about somebody who was virtually almost killed by stepping on a nail because he got inappropriate care. The person who finally made the right diagnosis was a third-year medical student who didn't have a computer, who was just talking to him, did a careful exam, and figured out what was going on that had been missed by, you know, five or six doctors before her.
Well, let us take another phone call. Here's James in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Mark Vonnegut.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I heard you say earlier on that, as you suggested, that people not try to get Medicare for all, but using, as I understood it, you suggested an incremental method of identifying actions that were not in the patient's benefit in the corporations and the hospitals and the insurance companies, and regulating that they not be able to do those things. And it just struck me that, first of all, that leaves the whole structure of profit in place, even if they do.
I'm
not sure where James went, but okay. So pick it up there. What is it you do advocate, Mark?
The profits are in fact made by co-payments, deductibles, prior authorizations, putting rural hospitals out of business. So and there are many ways. I've watched people screw up medicine for 40 years. There are many ways. If you left the private insurers in charge of supplemental policies to Medicare for All, they could screw it up. If you kept to the rule of do no harm for everybody, you would get rid of most of the sources of profit, and you would again have payers of medical insurance just paying for medical care. But I agree with you, 100%. There is truly at this point no real role for-profit medical care.
You're in Massachusetts and have practiced there your whole career. Having Romney Care, which became Obamacare at the federal level, has that made much of a difference in quality of care or amount of coverage?
It has, because it's made for a lot fewer uninsured people. And uninsured people, especially if they're sick, are very, very expensive for all of us. So anything that gives us fewer uninsured people is a good thing for medical care, and it's a good thing for all of us. The thing that a lot of people forget is that we pay for everything, either through taxes or, $20,000 a year in insurance premiums. The patient pays for everything. They call themselves,
they call themselves insurance companies, but what?
They don't really pay for anything. They make a 20% profit on everything that they allegedly pay for, and all that money comes from us.
Well, this is an example of the range of essays in the book, that we get these analyses of insurance that talk about people who are hacking and making a homebrew insulin because the other insulin costs so much, and individual stories of patients who got good care because people like Mark Vonnegut were paying attention. The book is called The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics by Dr. Mark Vonnegut. Thanks for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Take care.